Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Tonight's guest, Reverend Michael Dowd, self-described eco-theologian and pro-science evolutionary, says evidence is modern-day scripture and ecology must be the heart of theology. Reverend Dowd believes we have a sacred responsibility to future generations and explains how we can become ever more resilient in chaotic and challenging times. Dowd details his explanation of how religion can be used to frame the conversation around climate change and issues of ecology, and how we can move away from a destructive human-centered focus toward a nature-centered holistic view of the world and our place in it. This show was recorded on May 20th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show begins with the speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Welcome to the forum. My name is Craig Vollen, a member of the forum committee. The mission of the forum is to afford a platform for the discussion of significant issues, especially those which involve ethical values in the contemporary world. This morning we have a really interesting program, somewhat unusual for the forum because it's kind of a mixture of fact and spirituality. Normally we just talk about dull facts, but today we're going to have something a little different, and I'm looking forward to it. And we're going to be hearing from Reverend Michael Dowd, and I'll let him talk about his history a little bit about it. But he basically is an ecological evangelist. Michael.
Thanks, Greg. Good morning. So just a little background. I preached here about 9 or 10 years ago. Connie, my wife, is a science writer, and I'm a minister. We're both climate activists and environmental activists. And we've spoken to about 500 Unitarian Universalist churches and probably about 2,500 groups total over the last 16 years. We travel North America living in other people's homes, and we essentially focus on where science, inspiration, and sustainability intersect. And then 5 years ago, climate change went from being a back burner issue to a very much urgent front burner issue for us. And I started wearing this green clergy shirt a few years ago because I'm committed to the greening of religion. Because basically, religion is failing in its most fundamental task in culture. So the main thing I've been studying over the last several years from an evidence-based perspective, Connie and I are both sacred realists, we're religious naturalists. What I've been focusing on is the history. We've always been doing the history of everyone and everything, what's called big history or the universe story or the epic of evolution. But specifically, I've been focusing on the differences between sustainable cultures and unsustainable cultures. The very definition of sustainability is to live in a way that primary reality is not degraded. In other words, that we don't soil our own nest, as it were. So for a culture to be able to live in a way that could, for thousands of years, not diminish or destroy primary reality, the soil, the forest, the life upon which they depend, that's sustainable. Cultures that wash away the topsoil, cut down too many trees, over-harvest whatever their food sources are, whatever, or degrade the land in whatever way, or the oceans, those are unsustainable. And it turns out, interestingly enough, that religion plays the most important role in sustainable cultures. Not religion like we now see it. Religion as we now see it is comatose. I used to say religion is asleep at the wheel, but that's too tame of a metaphor. Half the religious people are gagged and tied in the trunk, and the other half of religious people are cheering on the psychopathic politicians that are driving us over the cliff. And so what I want to focus on just this morning is just a few sort of core elements of what we've been sharing with audiences all over North America. We just came from Phoenix, where I did about 19 presentations in Phoenix. We never had any rain. There was never any water. It's amazing how refreshing our souls were singing with the rain here. And the green plants and the trees. It's like what we, you know, our kind of mammal requires a certain level of water that I think we're going to see massive migration out of the desert Southwest and out of California over the over the coming decades. So I'd like to very briefly paint a picture that science gives us, just to give you a sense of my worldview, sort of where I'm coming from. I pastored 3 United Church of Christ congregations over the course of a decade, but I had 1 foot in the Unitarian Universalist Association during that whole time. So I've been a member of the UUA since 1988, even though the churches I pastored were United Church of Christ congregations. For the last 16 years, as I mentioned, Connie and I have traveled North America, speaking in colleges and churches and universities, literally everything from atheists to evangelicals, on the sacred side of science, basically. What's being revealed evidentially, scientific evidence, historic evidence, and cross-cultural evidence, interpreted in the most meaningful and inspiring ways, and in ways that help us live in a pro-future way. Right now, almost everything in our society is anti-future. That is, it is diminishing and destroying primary reality, and ultimately condemning our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren to hell and high water. And so understanding how we got here is helpful for most people, especially since the last major election. Many progressives and liberals are struggling to try to understand our times. And so I want to paint a picture of the history of everyone and everything. I'm wearing this, not just because this is a cool stole, but this is actually the universe story represented in beads. This is the 13.82 billion year history of the universe, rounded off to 14. So 14 billion year history of the universe represented in beads. So this is all of our names for reality or mystery, the Big Bang, the four fundamental forces in the early galaxy. I've got the whole story. I've got 270 beads, each bead signifying some significant event in the universe story. And then I also have the most significant events in my own personal life story, because my story is part of the great story. Your story is part of the great story. So if we compress the history of the universe into 100 years, just so we can conceptualize it. Carl Sagan did this, although he did it in a year. Neil deGrasse Tyson also did it in a year. Other people have tried to do it in a day. I like the 100-year timeline because that actually reflects our lived experience. Some of us know somebody who's lived 100 years old. And we can conceptualize 100 years, a full human lifetime, and even longer. And so at that time scale, every decade is 1.4 billion years. Each year on the cosmic century timeline is 140 million years. Each week is roughly 2.5 million years. Each day is 17,000 years. I'm obviously rounding these things off. And each minute on the cosmic century timeline is 250 years. And so at each year is about 5 years. So at that time scale, if you compress if the beginning of the universe, what scientists call the Big Bang, or what Connie and I call the Great Radiance, I mean, think about it, the beginning of everyone and everything, the Big Bang, like what does that make us, shrapnel? So the Great Radiance, at 1 second after midnight of the year zero, and right now, this moment, is midnight on December 31st of the 99th year, just about to go into the 100th year. At that time scale, all the hydrogen was created about day 2. Early galaxies, the first 25 or 30 years, and the bigger galaxies gobble up other ones. Our solar system forms at 67. Earth cools below the boiling point of water at 69, and it rains for eons, and all the oceans were essentially formed then, other than some icy comets that came in. At 71, Earth comes alive, and at 72, some of these bacteria can feed on the sun, photosynthesis. And then there's a long complexification of life. The dinosaurs are here from May of 98 to July of 99. And when do you suppose human beings show up on a 100-year timescale? The last week, Homo habilis, walking upright using stone tools, on December 25th of the 99th year, We domesticated fire on December 29th, and we've been speaking in words, symbolic language, on December 31st of the 99th year. So you've got an entire 100-year process, and the very last day is when human beings show up, when we emerge out of the body of life. Or if you want to use mythic language, when God or the goddess created us. Now let me say something about religious language. Because my creed, letting you know where I'm coming from, here's sort of my creed in a nutshell. Reality is my God. Meaning that reality is my ultimate commitment. Reality is what I'm committed to more than anything else. And we need to live in right relationship to reality or we're going to suffer. So reality is my God. Evidence is my scripture. Evidence is the best way reality reveals itself to us. Big history, the history of the universe, is my creation story. It's our first and only globally produced evidence-based creation story. So reality is my God, evidence is my scripture. Big history is my creation story, ecology is my theology. Ecology, of course, being the science, the interdisciplinary sciences. Ecology, of course, being the sciences of right relationship to time and nature. That is right relationship to reality, both in its temporal and its spatial manifestations. So reality is my God, evidence is my scripture. Big history is my creation story. Ecology is my theology. Integrity is my spiritual path. And by integrity, I mean the practices, the mindset and exercises that help me live in right relationship to reality. So reality is my God. Evidence is my scripture. Big history is my creation story. Ecology is my theology. Integrity is my spirituality or my spiritual path. And fostering a just and healthy future is my mission. Now, I suggest that those basic 6 points unite tens of millions of secular and religious people around the world. It's not about having the same beliefs. It's about having the same values, priorities, and commitments. Now, obviously, atheists, skeptics, free thinkers don't feel comfortable with the God talk. They might say reality is my ultimate commitment. Evidence is the way reality reveals itself, and so on. And conservative religious people, both Catholic and Protestant, among Christians, feel more comfortable with language like my God includes reality, my scripture includes evidence, my theology includes ecology. So the title of this talk, Reality Speaks, Factual Inspiration for Difficult Times. So what is reality telling us? Well, one of the most important things is that reality is telling us that there are just a few very basic, simple differences between sustainable cultures and unsustainable cultures. And the most important one is the role of religion in sustainable, stable societies. If religion is not comatose, if religion is not asleep at the wheel, basically if religion isn't human-centered, if it's life-centered, ecocentric, biocentric, then what religion does is it never allows the future to be compromised by the present. That's the fundamental role of religion, is to ensure that the future is never compromised by the present. Said in the language of philosopher of religion Loyal Rue, who's probably the most significant philosopher of religion alive, he says, all religions, if they're doing their job, promote ecological integrity, social coherence, and personal wholeness in that order. In other words, if we don't attend to primary reality as primary, that is, if we don't attend to the well-being of the soil, forest, life upon which we depend, if all we have are concerned with our human-centered concerns, then we can take primary reality for granted and ultimately let the soil wash away, cut down too many forests, you know, pollute things to where we ultimately suffer. So ecological integrity, social coherence, and personal wholeness. And it turns out Teddy Goldsmith, the guy who wrote a book called The Way, an Ecological Worldview, he was the founder and the editor of The Ecologist magazine for about 35 years. He died about a decade ago. And one of the things he identified in terms of the anthropological research is that there's 4 basic things that religions in sustainable culture do, that they are the control mechanism for stable, sustainable societies. And right now, our current existing religions on the planet, not just the religions of the book, actually, but most of the major religions, are failing in each of these 4 things. One is insisting that primary reality is related to as primary. to use religious language, God first, but not God as an otherworldly being, God as a sacred proper name for reality, reality with a personality, you could say. See, the other thing that history shows us, coming back to this 100-year time scale, I mentioned the last day we've had symbolic language. See, all species live in the present moment. They deal with whatever's thrown at them, and they make the best of it. That's what we do instinctually. But because we have symbolic language and words and beliefs, they can take us away from, but they can basically, we can create entire fictional understandings of reality that have no bearing on the nature of nature, the nature of the living world, the living biosphere, that can then cause serious problems, especially when we become addicted to, or what I call idolatry of the written word, idolatry of the otherworldly, and idolatry of beliefs. These are the three most significant forms of idolatry, that is human-centeredness, anthropocentrism, that exist currently. Idolatry of the written word is where you think where reality, our best map of reality is frozen in time in some ancient text. Idolatry of the otherworldly is where you think ultimate reality resides is only outside time and nature, rather than time and nature related to as a divine thou. And idolatry of beliefs is when we privilege beliefs over knowledge. So that's why one of the things that a lot of us are calling for is an evidential reformation, where evidence is seen as modern-day scripture. Evidence is seen as more authoritative than old men and old books. Because in addition to ensuring that primary reality is related to as primary, the other thing that religion, or there's four things. The second thing that religions have always done in sustainable societies is summed up in the seventh generation. The idea that we should make decisions today in terms of how it will impact the next seven generations isn't just a good idea. To do otherwise is evil. Seriously. Unsustainable is just a bland and deceptive word for evil. And any traditional culture knows this. And so insisting on the seventh generation, insisting that the future is never compromised by the present, is a fundamental role of religion. Because if it doesn't happen through those systems of meaning and systems of inspiration, where is it going to come from? This is one of the reasons why we see in city-based cultures pretty quickly, city-based totalitarian agriculture cultures, we start seeing religion pretty quickly getting co-opted by the elite for their purposes. So religion then doesn't function as a way of ensuring that primary reality is primary. That is, the soil, forest, life comes first. We have to attend to the living world, the living biosphere first. That's our first priority. And ensuring that the voices of future generations help us make decisions today. The third thing is sacred limits. Turns out that the most important ecological concept is also what I consider the most important theological concept, which is carrying capacity. There is a limited ability for the living world to provide resources for any species. This is not just true for humans. For any species, there's a limited amount of resources that can be provided and a limited ability to absorb waste before the system starts breaking down. It's called the carrying capacity of a bioregion or a continent or the planet as a whole. And when we exceed the grace limits, that is when we exceed the carrying capacity, then the system starts breaking down. So the whole idea is that limits are sacred and must be honored. Nothing is more important than honoring the limits of the living world. The challenge, this is what William Catton, who Connie is on my major intellectual mentor in the last several years is William Catton. His book, Overshoot, The Ecological Basis of Revolutionary Change. He wrote it in 1980. Many of us consider it the most important book of the 20th century and the most important book we've ever read. But one of the things he talks about is the fundamental predicament of humanity. This is not a problem that can be solved. This is a predicament that we have to adapt to and live with. Is that we have there's a mismatch between what we expect and the world as it really is. For example, Europe had achieved saturation. Europe was experiencing population pressure. There were too many humans living in a wasteful way for the systems of Europe, the forests and the soil and the living systems, to not degrade. And so we see this degradation of the living world. We see all kinds of conflict happening within the within Europe. And then an entire new hemisphere was discovered. Now, obviously, it was only discovered from the European perspective. It was fully inhabited from the indigenous perspective. But nonetheless, because some of our germs went ahead of most of us and wiped out 90% of the indigenous Americans, from the perspective of the Europeans, it appeared to be unlimited. Unlimited timber. You know, limitless resources of every kind. And the fact that we even treated them as resources. See, we've already objectified the world. We've been living with this idea that God is a clockmaker outside a clockwork universe. And again, I'm speaking generally for Western culture. And so what that did is it trivialized God. God was no longer synonymous with reality. God was now a clockmaker. That if you believe in the clockmaker, you're a theist. And if you disbelieve in the clockmaker, you're an atheist. And both sides treat the living world as an it to be exploited rather than a thou to be honored and respected. I consider the theist-atheist debate to be one of the greatest collective insanities of our time. Because one of the things that reality has revealed through evidence is that gods and goddesses are not disembodied entities. They are personifications of some aspect of reality. Almost always. There are few exceptions, but not many. Poseidon was not the god of the oceans. Poseidon was not the spirit of the oceans. Poseidon was a personification that is giving human characteristics to the oceans, which are inescapably real. Gaia was not the goddess of the earth or the spirit of the earth. Gaia was the earth personified that has given human characteristics to this planet that's inescapably real. Eros was not a personification of lust or love. Eros was a personification of lust or love. You can't understand the world's myths and religions if you don't understand our brain's propensity to give human characteristics to what's more than human. James Hillman, one of the most famous psychologists of the last 70 years, said, "Loving is a way of knowing, and for love to know, it must personify. Personifying is thus the heart's mode of knowing. It's not a lesser, primitive way of apprehending, but a finer one. To enter myth," he said, "we must personify, and to personify carries us into myth." Now, he's not using the word myth as an untrue story. He's meaning it the way Joseph Campbell did, a narrative that puts us in accord with the nature of reality. So that's why when I use the word God, I'm meaning only and always reality with a personality, not a person outside reality. I have no supernatural or otherworldly beliefs at all. And yet, I know we need to live in right relationship to reality or we're going to perish. In fact, there are some Catholic nuns and feminists who have begun spelling God, G-O-D-D-E. It's the old English spelling, G-O-D-D-E, because it's sort of gender neutral. It can be female, male. But again, it's the personification. It's not a person. So coming back to what we learn from sustainable versus unsustainable cultures, reality has revealed to us through evidence that religion, if it's doing its job, insists that primary reality is primary and is related to in an I-thou way, that the future is honored, future first, or it's the seventh generation, that limits are sacred and must be honored upon pain of death or ostracization. But limits are sacred and must be honored, including limits of size. You can't understand why so many indigenous ancient cultures and tribal peoples practice some form of infanticide at times if you don't understand the need to limit population. Otherwise, you overshoot the carrying capacity. I'm not advocating infanticide. I'm just saying that limits are sacred. So, in fact, what we now know is that the most important way to reduce population is to teach girls to read. The empowerment of women worldwide is the single most predictive factor for bringing down birth rate. So, God first, or primary reality as primary, seventh generation, sacred limits. And the other thing that religion must do, which is failing in every possible way right now, is to ensure what's called consequence capture. That is, the impact of individuals and groups on the whole needs to be reflected back to the whole, or back to the part. Think nesting dolls, like Russian nesting dolls, subatomic particles within atoms, within molecules, within cells, within organisms, and those all the way up. That's the nature of creativity, not God as clockmaker creating like a man a clock, and so the clock's this it over there, and God's over here. No, it's this nested creativity. Every level can create. And so an economic system that allows a subset of the whole to benefit at the expense of the whole is insane. We have a global economic system where it's not only possible and profitable for a subset of the whole to benefit at the expense of whole, but there's this tremendous reward, the whole system. We have when I speak in religious settings, I'm realizing that this is not usually sort of religious language, but when I speak, I just spoke to 15 Christian churches and church Christian groups and one Jewish synagogue in Phoenix. So we have a system where the playing field has been tipped. Teddy Goldsmith, the guy who wrote the book The Way, The Ecological Worldview, he says, isn't it amazing and rather astonishing that we could cause our own extinction and completely degrade the living world and cause the extinction of many other species without breaking a single law? We have an evil economic system. We have a demonic economic system. Now, I realize this is not language that humanists and atheists and freethinkers and Unitarians typically use. It's not just the language of reverence. It's the language of repulsion. It's the language of limits. It's the language of speaking to the sacred. And the living world is sacred if anything is. Yet we have an economic system. You tell me if this is an accurate portrayal of our economic system. We have an economic system that rewards the few at the expense of the many, measures progress by how fast we can take the biosphere and turn it into pollution, and forces billions of us to betray the future just by pursuing the good life. So any system that makes it easier or inevitable for millions of normal people to do evil, well, if the word demonic has any meaning in a modern context, it's got to include that. That's why I said my analogy of half the religious people are in the back seat cheering on the psychopathic politicians driving us over the cliff. That's what I was getting at, is that we have an economic system that we can't just make little tweaks. It has to shift from human-centeredness to life-centeredness. If there were one thing that we most need to do that history teaches, that reality, that the universe, that God is teaching us, it's that we must measure progress in life-centered terms, not human-centered terms. Gross domestic product, gross national product, GDP, other human-centered measures are not enough. We have to measure progress and success by how well the soil is doing decade by decade, how well the forests are doing decade by decade, how well the fisheries are doing decade by decade, what's the carbon parts per million in the atmosphere decade by decade. It's the only way we will avoid extinction. And we know this because every sustainable culture that we know of measured progress or success, if they even had those concepts, which most of the time they didn't. What was most needed was to simply learn from the living world, what is its way? What's the way of nature, the way of life? And then mimic that way for human civilization so that our laws, our medicine, our politics, our economics, our education is aligned with the way things have been for millions of years, evolution, natural selection, the whole process, and ecology, so that we can move into a just, healthy, and sustainably life-giving future. So consequence capture is this fourth thing, and it's ensuring that the impact of parts on the whole is reflected back to the parts. So individuals, corporations, and nation states that have a positive impact on the larger community of life or on the future should be rewarded, and the more they should be rewarded. So their incentive is to profit by doing good. And individuals, corporations, and nations that disregard or harm the common good or harm the future should be taxed or penalized, or there's moral strictures, so that it's in their self-interest to do the right, just, ecological thing, and it's also in their self-interest to not do the unjust, unecological thing. So let me just sort of wind this down in the next 5 minutes and say the fundamental insight that William Catton offers in his ecological understanding is that we have a world where, because of the sense of limitlessness in the new world and all of the institutions and the mindset that emerged out of that sense of limitlessness, and then when we discovered coal, oil, and natural gas, you know, that sense of limitlessness went just to the moon, literally. We've shipped that mindset and institutions of limitlessness all around the world. So the people in China, the people in India, the people in Bangladesh all expect eventually, and this is what they're promised by our multinational corporations and by our television advertising and everything else, that they will eventually be able to live like middle-class Americans. Except that we'd need like 10 planets for that to be the case. It's not possible. So the fundamental predicament of humanity is we are actually now living in a world of carrying capacity deficit. We don't have enough carrying capacity for 7 billion people, much less 8 or 9 billion. Yet we have shipped the expectations of limitlessness and the expectations that reflect a world of carrying capacity surplus, which is what America had through about 1970 or so, is a sense of carrying capacity surplus. We've shipped those expectations all over the world. And it's reflected in the United Nations Charter. It's reflected everywhere. We have a world of carrying capacity deficit, yet we have a carrying capacity surplus mindset and institutions. So the last thing I want to say before we just open it up is one of the things we've learned through evidence, one of the things that reality has been telling us through all forms of evidence, and yes, I'm personifying reality, is that we have 32 examples. Remember my 100-year timeline? We live for 97% of the last day from midnight on December 30th until about 11:20 p.m. on December 31st. So for like 95% of the last day on a 100-year time scale, we live more or less sustainably. We live more or less in a mutually enhancing relationship with primary reality. Then we started developing totalitarian agriculture, human-centered agriculture. There are forms of agriculture and permaculture and agroecology and horticulture that can be profoundly sustainable. But once it becomes fully human-centered, then we start seeing this domination mindset, dominating the world, hierarchies, domination of women. This mindset of domination then always destroys primary reality. All city-based civilizations, 32 of them, have become great, and then they've fallen. And another civilization takes 2 or 5 centuries to become great, and 1 or 2 centuries to decline, and a dark age. We know 32 examples of civilizations that have risen and fallen. And once you can set them side by side, as historians such as Spengler and Arnold Toynbee, they spent a career looking at the common patterns of civilizations rising and falling. And you start recognizing that they all rise and create different things in their greatness, but they almost all fall the same, the common patterns. And so then when we look at our society and our world now, we realize, holy God, we're 40 years into catabolic collapse. We're 40 years into decline. That's what the Rust Belt is. President Trump will not be able to make America great again for a bunch of reasons, but the main one is we don't have the energy. We don't have the cheap, dense, concentrated energy. Yes, it's possible, probably, to sustain or to energize some form of civilization based on renewable energy, but not this kind of civilization. So we're in contraction, and what's possible in times of economic expansion, what's possible in times of ecological exuberance, that's the actual ecological term, that when there's more than enough resources for any species, it's an age of exuberance. We're now 40 years into post-exuberance. We're into contraction. And so everything's going to shift. And so one of the sacred things is, how do we plant trees? How do we build topsoil? How do we build closer community? And how do we plant the seeds for healthy forms of religion and healthy forms of culture as things are declining? That's the great work of our time. And it will continue for all of your lifetimes and all of our kids' lifetimes, unless we've already triggered certain climate tripping points that are so bad that, you know, our species could go extinct in the next 100 years. Actually, I'm a short-term pessimist, but I'm a long-term optimist. I think we're going to survive the bottleneck, but I think it's inevitable that there will be less than a billion human beings on the planet before end of century, just through drought, famine, war, and living in a post-antibiotic age. And so understanding this, I just want to say one political thing. Where Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump agreed scared me more than their differences. Because they both agreed that economic growth is our only way into the future. And economic growth, endless economic growth on a finite planet is impossible. It's thermodynamically impossible, ecologically impossible. And yet you couldn't get elected if unless you say that. Even Bernie Sanders had to be for economic growth. So we're in decline. And understanding this, understanding the patterns, allows us to be present to the challenges, the chaos, the stupidity of our times from a place of compassion and generosity and engaged action. What one of my mentors, Joanna Macy, calls active hope. It's moving through the stages of grief. We're all going to feel the stages of grief. If you haven't felt anger, if you haven't felt some form of denial, if you haven't felt, you know, a depression, you're not paying attention. But ultimately, we can support each other moving through that to active hope, engaged action. And this is what reality is telling us. And I think fundamentally, religion needs a born-again experience. Religion needs to be saved, because right now it's worse than bad. It's actually causing good people to do evil. One of the reasons why America isn't leading the world on climate change is because 41% of Americans believe these are the end times anyway, so why bother? You're not going to be committed to what the world's going to be like 100 years from now if you believe that Jesus is coming back and the whole thing's ending in the next decade or two or three. So that's what I mean. Good people become dangerous when their worldview is not aligned with reality. All right, let me stop. Questions, response, feedback.
We're now going to have questions and answers. Remember, everybody gets one question until everybody has a chance, and no statements and speeches. You'll have a chance to do that afterwards in the library. Michael is and Connie have agreed to meet us back in the library after the forum for additional discussion. So now I'll hand it back over to Michael.
Although enjoy might be the wrong term, it's certainly enlightening. I agree with everything you say, and our need to do something is just imperative. What concerns me, and I'd ask you to address yourself this, what concerns me today is this absolute powerful onslaught of, for a lack of a better term, right-wing propaganda machine, whether it's Fox News, Rush Limbaugh, the right-wing. Unbelievable. I'm 75. I've never seen anything like it, nor the power of it. I know good, decent, educated fellow lawyers who are as ignorant as some person in the Amazon jungle 500 years ago. How are we going to counter this?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I don't have a great answer. One of the things that history shows us, that reality is telling us through evidence, is that in declining civilizations, we talk about the collapse of the Roman Empire. You get the sense that it collapsed like this, but it didn't. It took 320 years for Rome to collapse. It was a stair step. It's what John Michael Greer, one of our favorite authors, calls the long descent. And there were partial recoveries. That's the way almost all civilizations contract, in a stair step kind of way. And the two most common mythologies that we have seen in the last several thousand years of collapsing civilizations. One is the myth of perpetual progress, which is denial. Things aren't bad. Things are keep getting better and better. And for a very small elite, that sometimes is true. But typically what happens is the middle class gets completely washed out, the poor class grows exponentially, and the elite and powerful, it goes ever smaller but ever wealthier, until basically there's such a gap that there's a revolt, and they end up as lamppost decorations because they can't protect themselves forever. So one is the myth of perpetual progress, which is deep denial. The other is the myth of the apocalypse. See, both of those keep us from being engaged. If I believe that things are just going to keep getting better and better, I don't need to change my life. I don't need to do anything different. But if I believe the whole thing's going to hell in a handbasket, I don't need to do anything different. I don't need to change anything. And it turns out that in declining civilizations, those two myths are the least likely. It's almost never either one of those. It's always muddling through. So I wish I had encouraging words for you. One of the things we do, when Donald Trump got elected, I expected a year before the election that he would win, unless Bernie Sanders had won the Democratic. Bernie probably could have beaten him. But even then, the idea that one politician is going to be able to make the difference is also a form of insanity. Yes, especially locally, individual politicians can make a big difference. And yes, it would have been hugely different had Bernie been in the White House than Trump. No question. But the systems have been unsustainable for so long and so human-centered that we really need far more fundamental shifts. And what you're saying is very educated, bright lawyers and doctors and others who are, you know, can be clueless in terms of ecology, in terms of history, in terms of evolution. And it's scary. It is.
You said that you were relatively optimistic in the long run. But what evidence can you bring forth in view of the third and fourth world expectations in relation to what the middle class in the U.S. has, and also in view of the greatly worsening carbon emissions and other ecological discouragements?
Yeah. When I call myself an apocaloptimist, I got that from a young woman in Australia, apocaloptimism. And the stance of an apocaloptimist is basically this. It's the shift from human-centeredness to life-centeredness. So the stance of an apocaloptimist is, of course we're screwed. Thank God. So I expect tremendous suffering over the course of this century. I have no confidence that my kids or grandkids are going to survive the bottleneck. I have no confidence that millions of species will still go extinct because of the unbelievable damage that we are doing. But in the same way that, I don't know if you saw that movie Avatar, but there's the scene when the colonel basically says that, you know, he's talking about they're going to blow up this tree, and he said we're going to create a crater in their racial memory that they will never, ever forget. I think that the collapse of industrialism and the collapse of the ecosystems upon which we depend is going to be so severe that if several million or more human beings survive the bottleneck, which again, I think they will, however long humans are here, which could be another 2 or 3 million years before an asteroid or supervolcano takes us out, we will remember and not go back to doing that kind of human-centered. I think it will be that severe. But so my confidence, my trust, it's not confidence, it's trust, but it's also trust with the sense that we could easily go extinct. That's not outside the realm of possibility. But what gives me hope is that the worst case scenario, let's say we have World War III or World War IV and it goes nuclear and we all go extinct and we take many other species down with us and all of our nuclear power plants melt down. Worst case scenario. By early February on the 101st year, okay, we talk about the 100-year timeline. If you go out one more month, that's 12 million years. Earth will have recovered. Earth recovered from the dinosaur extinction in that amount of time. And so we're not going to see worst case scenario. And I think that there will be life forms that survive. I think that raccoons will probably be the next self-reflexive intelligence, the next technological species, because they have the manual dexterity. And John Michael Greer thinks that the third technological species, like 100 million years from now, are likely to be the descendants of the crows. Right? So at any rate, my faith is in life, and my faith is in life even if humans go extinct, even though I'm doing everything I possibly can, given my gifts and limitations, to help ensure that we do make in the next 10 years, we do what needs to be done to avoid hell. To use religious metaphors, we can't avoid purgatory, but we can still avoid hell, I think. and then to plant the seeds of healthy religiosity so that whatever religion emerges on the other side of the bottleneck, on the other side of the coming dark age, whatever religions emerge, they embrace ecology and evolution as sacred, and they value what collective intelligence, what science has revealed, in the same way that current religious people value old texts.
You made a couple of passing references to our city-based culture without really explaining. You referred to it in what sounded to me in a fairly derogatory way, but could you explain what you mean by the impact of city-based culture?
Yeah. So we don't have any examples currently of city-based cultures that have I mean, the oldest ones, some Chinese cultures have lasted a long time, and Egyptian cultures have lasted thousands of years. But most city-based cultures overshoot the carrying capacity of their region, unless you've got a situation like the Nile that keeps replenishing, although now with the dams, they don't do that. So well, that was kind of stupid. But we also didn't understand the way that we now do scientifically about ecology. We can build topsoil. We can plant trees. We can assist trees that would go extinct if it was just on their natural basis. But human beings can take seeds from several hundred miles further south that are heat adapted and plant those seeds several hundred miles north, and they're assisting in the migration of trees. So we know how to mimic ecology. And city-based civilizations that mimic ecology, that's a whole different ball of wax. We just haven't had those yet. I am encouraged that the leadership in China is at least using the language of ecological civilization, but they're still profoundly human-centered. So it hasn't fleshed out yet.
Do you see religion as having any part in, well, starting with interplanetary exploration? I mean, after all, we're one little sphere among billions and billions and billions of additional one. I mean, for any kind of solutions or explorations or settlement or anything else.
So one of the things that here's a sort of confession. I say this with some embarrassment. Thomas Berry was my great mentor from 1988 until he died in 2009. He called himself a geologian. He was one of the most significant ecological and evolutionary thinkers. And one of the things he said was that to put too much time and energy and effort into exploring outer space and thinking that we're going to live on Mars or live in some other world before coming into right relationship again, as we did for 97% of our history, with this living planet. He called that blasphemy. So the idea that we're going to get off the planet and live on Mars, for example, or colonize Mars, What most people don't understand is the incredible amounts of energy that are required to even go to the moon and back, much less other star systems. And then you factor in solar rays and things like this, solar radiation. Elon Musk, he's a great guy, I'm sure, and he's got, you know, some positive visions, but he is completely deluded, in my opinion, that we're going to colonize Mars. So I am excited about what science has been made possible in terms of our exploration of this solar system and all the things we've learned about the galaxies and the Hubble. And I mean, what I'm hoping is that the major scientific understandings that we have gained in the last 150 years are preserved into the future so that we don't lose those understandings. And some of the most exciting stuff is the stuff we've learned about the solar system and about stars and about evolution and big history and galaxies and the universe and all that stuff. So I'm excited by all that, but I don't think we're going to colonize. And your question, do I think religion has a role? Well, not until it has some kind of born-again experience. I mean, as long as religion is justifying destroying the future by how we're living in the present, I don't see religion having that role.
It's nice to think about 10 million years from now and how we would be changing things or creating sustainability to it. But it appears to me, and would you please comment on this thought, that there's a faction in our society and the world that have sustainability for actually obsolete technologies and bad ideas, and like perpetuating nuclear power and the like. And they've created other methods to essentially sustain that so that it would last longer, because as an idea that they're correcting the environmental hazards.
Yeah, I'm really glad you raised this point, because the word sustainability has been so bastardized. It's been so abused. The idea that we can sustain what is unsustainable. And many people are using sustainability in that kind of a way, such as, you know, sustainable nuclear energy, for example. One of the things that a lot of people don't factor in is the economics. Nuclear power has never, ever once been affordable. It's never been able to pay for itself. The only reason nuclear power has ever existed is massive government subsidies, usually because we also wanted nuclear weapons. And so if nuclear power had to compete with other forms of energy, even basic forms of energy, it never can. And so, yeah, this I call it the techno-fetish religion of everlasting growth. And it's insane. But we're going to hit the... Robert Louis Stevenson, I love this quote. He says, "Sooner or later, we all sit down to a banquet of consequences." See, that's the great reckoning. We are in the early stages of the great reckoning. Not because some supernatural deity is pissed off at us and punishing us. It's because there's consequences when we live out of right relationship to reality. But I do believe it could also be the great homecoming. The prodigal species, after squandering our inheritance, we're waking up to our predicament in the pig pen, as it were, and coming home to reality.
Waking up to our predicament. Thank you very much. Technological fundamentalism is a phrase which well describes what you were just talking about. I'm trying to look at something a little bit rosier, and I would like you to comment on. There is growing on at least the coasts a movement of young people in very small groups with very small acreages developing sustainable farming. There are even a few forces that are loaning them the money to buy land, which is so expensive nowadays. Would you comment on this and leave us with a little hope for that billion people who will survive what's coming?
I'm so glad that you raised that. And yeah, I'll conclude with this, because there are thousands and thousands of examples of young people who get the kind of stuff that I've been talking about, who get that the only sustainable way into the future is to come home to their locality and begin to treat the soil and the forest as sacred again, learn to grow food, learn to can food, preserve, and have it's stepping outside, in many cases, stepping outside the market economy, which treats everything as a commodity that can be have a price. So yes, those are some of the things that I find deeply encouraging, is the relocalization and falling back in love with life and living processes, including soil and growing food, and that young people are definitely leading that charge. So thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Michael will be available in the library for further discussion, and also he's going to talk a little bit about the information he's got available.
So Connie and I, for the last 16 years, have traveled, and what we do is we develop a program. We spend a year or two developing a program, then we videotape it, and then we develop an entirely new program. And so one of the things we started doing just a few years ago is selling a little flash drive that has 30 hours of our best video work, the best programs we've done over the last 16 years on the sacred side of science. And we've always given people the rights to make copies of our DVDs, but a lot of people don't know how to do that. With a flash drive, all you got to do is loan it to your friends and neighbors and family. It takes about a half hour to drag and drop the whole contents to their computer. So it's a great way to share this religious naturalism perspective, this pro-future way of thinking. So the fact that I'm not doing an evening program with full PowerPoint, multimedia, the program that I would have done is actually the third program on this. But if you get one of these, definitely share it with your friends and neighbors, because it's a great way to share this perspective with others.
Okay, in appreciation for your presentation, we're giving you one of the UU Forum mugs, which is American-made and union-made. Now, next week is our last program of this season. We take the summer off because we're all exhausted. But next week is going to be a favorite here at the Forum, Burdette Loomis. He's a professor. I think he's emeritus now at Kansas University. And his subject is going to be Chaos or Continuity, the U.S. in an Age of Disruption. So I really encourage you to come to that service. So thanks for attending the Forum.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Reality Speaks, Factual Inspiration for Difficult Times, with Reverend Michael Dowd. This program was recorded on Sunday, May 20th, at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within one day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.